You've probably heard me talk about my dog, Jackson. He's my baby boy. And as he's gotten older, he's gotten really finicky about eating. He used to get so excited about food, he'd literally spin. Well, not anymore. In fact, I often have to spoon feed him to get him to eat. Well, no more. Not since we started feeding him fresh food made with whole ingredients, backed by veterinary science. It's Nom Nom. Now, I actually tried making food for him myself. I'd cook up big batches of chicken or beef with vegetables and rice or potatoes, but without knowing what I was doing, he wasn't getting the vitamins and minerals he needed, and certainly not in the correct balance. That's all changed now with Nom Nom. Go to trynom.com, trynom.com/sentbynicole. They'll ask you some questions about your pup and tailor a specific amount of individually packaged Nom Nom meals and send them to you. By using my special URL, trynom.com/sentbynicole, you'll get 50% off of your first order, plus free shipping, and it's a great way to help support this show, too. Again, that's trynom.com/sentbynicole. Plus, Nom Nom comes with a money-back guarantee. If your dog's tail isn't wagging within 30 days, Nom Nom will refund your first order. No fillers, no nonsense, just Nom Nom.
The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
It is. And it's a Monday. Welcome to it. And it's not just any Monday. Let me tell you something. I'm here today, but I'm not really here today. This morning, I had a colonoscopy. Ooh, yeah, you know, it's something that, it's a sort of a rite of passage when you reach a certain age. Actually, that age here in the U.S. is 50. That's when they tell you to have your first colonoscopy. This was my third, yeah, because I'm 60. So I'm almost 61. You know by now, my birthday is November 4th, so I'm counting on you to vote and vote the right way and vote early and make sure your vote is counted so that when I awaken on my birthday, we already know who the winner is. I know it's a tall order, but, you know, I deserve it. Anyway, so I did. I had that done this morning, not only the colonoscopy, but the upper endoscopy as well. And here's where I become Mama Nicole and tell you, don't put this stuff off. I also got a flu shot last week, and it took a whopping 2 minutes, five, okay, with filling out the paperwork and everything, 5 minutes. They gave me a shot. The only side effect I had was a little bit of soreness in my arm for a day. Take care of yourselves. Right now, you know, we are our own best defense. So, anyway, I was planning on not being here today. I was just going to put together like a best of show with new material. But I decided as long as I have to run it anyway, I may as well be in here. Oh, just so you know, the colonoscopy, perfect. My colon is beautiful. Not even a polyp to biopsy. Nothing. Everything looked good. The upper is another story. I have a hiatal hernia. That means it's disgusting when you think about it. It's like your stomach goes up through into your esophagus. And that's why I get acid reflux and heartburn. And it's all part of that. There's not a whole lot I can do about it. So, but I got it checked out because, again, there was something going on in my upper, you know, above the stomach area. And I wanted to make sure it, you know, wasn't cancer or anything. So, got it done. I don't have to think about it for another 5 years. So get yourself checked. Don't put off going to the doctor. I'll tell you something. Doctor's offices are more safe now than they have been in years because of all the precautions they're taking. And this was done at the Cleveland Clinic. Cleveland Clinic has a Florida hospital in Weston, and they also have a satellite building in Coral Springs where I live. And so I was there at 6:30 this morning. that's, again, and the procedure was supposed to be at 8:30. It wound up being at 9:30, and I've been sort of out of it all day. So I figured I'd just come in here and like host the thing live. I've got two interviews I'm going to share with you today. They were both recorded in the last couple of months or so, and they they're both really good. So I'm happy to share them with you. Actually, I've been holding on to them knowing that today was going to be a sort of a quasi day off. So later on in the hour, we're going to hear from somebody you've heard me talk about with Howie Klein, Liam O'Mara. Liam O'Mara is a fascinating man, and he is a Democratic nominee running for Congress in California's 42nd district. That is like the San Bernardino area. But Liam O'Mara is fascinating. He's a historian. He's a college professor. Really, really smart man. I've spoken to him a couple of times. And I taped this interview a few weeks ago. So we'll listen to that towards the end of the hour. But we're going to start today with, a little game show, I guess, because, you know, Donald is a game show host. That's really his claim to fame. But the game show today is on a more serious topic. It's called Who Wants to Be an Autocratic Dictator? And we know the answer to that one, don't we? So I guess we should just start and do it. I actually spoke with, I'll just hit the videotape, Jim, as they say. Take it away, Nicole. Joining us today is Kenneth C. Davis. He's a New York Times bestselling author of America's Hidden History and Don't Know Much About History, which gave way to a whole series of Don't Know Much About books. The website is don'tknowmuchabout.com. Kenneth, thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for writing this book because the timing is perfect. The new book is Strongman, The Rise of Five Dictators and the Fall of Democracy. Who's this book aimed at?
Well, it's aimed at everyone, actually. I know that's an easy thing to say. A few years ago, after a whole lifetime, a professional lifetime of writing for adults, I Don't Know Much About History, by the way, was published 30 years ago. It's hard for me to believe that. But I had always written for adults thinking that they had gone through school and hadn't learned the things they were supposed to learn. And it was meant as a refresher course. Over time, I found a lot of teachers were using my books in the classroom because they were much more accessible, approachable, interesting, entertaining for their students. And I started to go into classrooms about 10 years ago via Skype largely, and had this really extraordinary learning experience of speaking to young people across the country and around the world in some cases, and finding them engaged, interested, curious, articulate, completely opposite the typical media presentation of young people in this country. So I really decided that the way to make a difference, a real dent in this problem that we have with talking about history in this country, was to write directly to them. Now, that being said, while it's a book that is ostensibly aimed at young adults, I don't write or speak differently to young people than I do to adults. I try and speak to everyone in the same voice, the way I'm speaking to you now.
Sure.
Conversationally, accessibly, and honestly, and a focus on accuracy and facts. And my experience with writing these books that are aimed at a slightly younger audience is that most adults read them and they don't know the difference. They're very happy, in fact, that they're, one, a little shorter, two, they're very illustrated, and three, the type is bigger.
Yes.
So this is, you know, these are stories that are meant for everyone. And ideally, in my view, this is something that becomes a kitchen table conversation that parents and adults, generations can read my books together and sit down and talk about what they mean and how they factor into their lives.
Right. Well, I asked the question because I noticed that, you know, the according to the publisher, it's aimed at school age, middle school and high school kids. But you don't talk down to anyone. I mean, it's eminently readable. And as you mentioned, there are photographs and there are charts and there are graphs, and it's very accessible. So you're bringing a very heavy, tough subject to a very wide audience here. So this book, Strong Man, The Rise of Five Dictators and the Fall of Democracy, outlines the rise of Mussolini, Hitler, Stalin, Mao Zedong, and Saddam Hussein. Why those five? Any reason in particular that you narrowed it down to them?
Certainly, let's take the first four first, because I think that those are kind of household names mm-hmm. for people in respect. We've all heard of Mussolini. We've all heard of Hitler and Stalin. Most of us have heard of Chairman Mao mm-hmm. Zedong. And certainly in our time, Saddam Hussein has been a character on the world stage and certainly a significant character in American history. But I chose these five because I think in one way they all truly typify the type that I'm writing about, the authoritarian, the strongman, the dictator. All of them use very, very similar techniques, first of all, to come into power and then to accumulate and concentrate their power. So they're, and certainly in the annals of 20th century history, there could have been a number of other ruthless dictators who I might have included. But I wanted to, first of all, address this kind of idea of household names about whom many people don't really know who they are, what they did, how they came to power. And I think that their story is so instructive for our time. One other connection between Saddam and the earlier ones is that Saddam was actually known as the Stalin on the Tigris. He studied Stalin. He had his secret police sent to East Germany at one point to learn Stalinist techniques. So there are threads certainly that connect all of these men. And we have to understand how quickly not all of them came to power in democracies. Some certainly did. How quickly rights, freedoms, privileges, the things that we have come to take for granted as Americans can disappear. It does not die in darkness. Sometimes it dies in broad daylight mm-hmm. while thousands cheer.
You know, perfect example. And it's perfect timing as well that you tell these stories, because many of us here in the United States are concerned about the direction Donald Trump is taking this country and who his idols, for lack of a better term, are. The world leaders that he tends to want to associate with are of the strongman variety. It's Vladimir Putin. It's Erdogan of Turkey. It's Duterte of the Philippines. It's seemingly the worst of the worst, while he basically blows off our allies. and it makes you wonder what his motivation is. And so you look at the rise of some. So just for a moment, if you would, give us the history of Adolf Hitler. He didn't rise to power by a military coup or anything. He ran for the presidency, I guess, and he was appointed chancellor. He came up through legitimate means, right?
That's absolutely correct. The opening chapter of the book presents Hitler already in power at this moment when the German parliament burns to the ground, essentially, and he uses that moment to take the power he's been given constitutionally and expand it exponentially overnight. So how does he come to power? Exactly as you said, Hitler and Mussolini were both creations of democratic constitutional republics. And it's important to understand that we see them very often in history in military garb. They adopted that as their image because these men tend to be very militaristic. But both men were put into power in democracies. Mussolini first, and that's why I tell his story first, mm-hmm. and it's influential to Hitler. And then Hitler, of course, later on. Hitler was the leader of the Nazi Party, a party within a large number of parties in Germany at the time. There's chaos in the government because nobody can put together a cohesive government. Germany is having extreme economic problems because of conditions in the country after World War I, a very significant event in all of these stories, by the way. And he runs for president, finishes second to Paul Hindenburg, a World War I hero in Germany. Mm-hmm. And as the country is in complete chaos, they turn to Hitler thinking that they will be able to control this rather useful idiot. And that's a very dangerous estimation that people have made. So Hitler is made, even though he's not elected himself, he is made the prime minister or chancellor of Germany. He moves very quickly, as I mentioned, with the burning of the Reichstag to secure those powers. He quickly overturns many constitutional protections, bans other political parties, bans the free press, starts to arrest and jail his opponents. And even as I say that to you right now, to focus on this moment in our history, just today, again, we have the president calling for the investigation, the jailing of his predecessor and his political opponent. This is strongman techniques. Now, I want to be very clear that I do not mention the current president at all book.
Right?
It's a book of history. But I do think that the lessons and the strong man's playbook that I outline are very important for us to realize, understand, and accept. And yes, this president seems to be excessively fond of these men because what do they all really want? They don't have an ideology necessarily, some more so than others. They want power.
Yep.
The point of power is power. The point of torture is torture, as George Orwell wrote. The point of a dictatorship is being dictator. And I think that it's that quest for unlimited personal power that ties all of these men together and makes them such a person appealing to a man like the president.
Our guest is Kenneth C. Davis. His brand new book, just out this week, is called Strongman, The Rise of Five Dictators and the Fall of Democracy. And you just mentioned the strongman's playbook, and it's in the final chapter, which you call Never Again, ? And it reminded me of something else that I've dealt with a lot over the last, especially 3.5 years, 4 years, which is there are a number of essays that have been written about fascism and the signs of fascism. And this reminds me an awful lot of that. What, you know, there seems to be some confusion. I want to get into this playbook in a second, but I want to ask you as a historian about fascism. We have a controversy, which is astounding to me right now in this nation, where there's a very loose ideology. It's not an organization called Antifa. It's basically people who are dedicated to fighting fascism. I'm Antifa. I'm anti-fascist. Yet we have a president who's saying Antifa is fascism. Antifa are terrorists. While he defends the actions of white supremacy groups who go around committing acts of fascism. I call it opposite world. What is your take on this disconnect?
Yes, and of course, Orwell laid this all out for us in 1984 with Newspeak and turning reality on its head and making words the opposite of what they mean. And yes. 2 + 2 = 5. My father, my late father, was Antifa. It was called joining the U.S. Army after Pearl Harbor.
Absolutely.
And he went to North Africa and Italy and was in the, you know, the anti-fascist army that was created in the aftermath of Pearl Harbor. So it's astonishing to me that we are even having a debate about this in some respects, because I grew up believing that, you know, that was what we what we were taught as children. And I certainly grew up in the generation where we had to duck and cover under the under the desks, because the other great bugaboo of the time after World War II was communism. So we had these two great isms that were really bad things. And that's the background out of which I write my books and understand history and try and bring the past to the present. Let me just briefly talk about fascism, because it is unfortunately a word that gets thrown around a lot.
Yes.
And we have in this book, Strongman, the man who really uses it as a label for what he's doing, Mussolini. He comes, he creates a political party in the aftermath of World War I. Again, very significant event in all of these histories. And he calls it the fascist party. I won't go into the Italian version. I'm trying to learn Italian, but I won't trouble you with that right now.
Okay.
What is the fascis that Mussolini is referring to? It was a symbol of power in the Roman Republic, and Mussolini, like many of these leaders, was reaching back for symbols of a great past. He was saying, our country was once great. We had a great civilization. We are going to restore that great civilization. So he chooses this symbol, which is essentially a bundle of rods bound together with an axe head in the center. It was a symbol of power and authority that a man actually carried around in the Roman Republic and later on under Caesar. So it had real resonance in Italy. It meant something. And it's no accident, if you go to Milan, there's a train station there, the central station in Milan, built by Mussolini. And there on the exterior, on the facade, is the fascis.
Wow.
Along with symbols of ancient Rome, horses and giant, powerful figures, he was trying to recall this almost mythical past of a Roman glory. He uses the symbol of the fascis. By the way, it's not unknown in America, as I point out in the book. You can see the fascis in the Congress. It's in the House of Representatives on the wall. When you see Nancy Pelosi standing there, there are fascis behind her.
Wow.
There are fascis on the seat that Abraham Lincoln sits on in the Lincoln Memorial. There's a fascis under George Washington at Federal Hall. This was seen as a 19th century symbol of leadership, authority, order, and rule. Then converted by Mussolini into a very different meaning of fascism. So when people say to me, well, what is fascism? Fascism was not an ideology in the same sense that other socialism, communism, democratic capitalism. They are ideologies that we can think about and explain. Fascism existed, as I was saying before, for the point of power. Mussolini's only interest was really power. Did he do things to change his country? Absolutely. Did he have a program to change his country? Absolutely. But it was a program that was essentially designed to coalesce and create more power for him and his party. That was the essence of his fascism.
Right. And in reading what you lay out as the strongman's playbook, it seems to echo these characteristics of fascism. So you talk about the blueprint that go into the making of a dictatorship. Extreme nationalism that calls for restoring a country's past glory or greatness, placing blame on a single group, usually an ethnic or religious minority or foreign threat, warning of an emergency, often non-existent, or responding to severe economic distress that threatens the nation, calls for law and order and eliminating corruption. All of these are hallmarks of Donald Trump's presidency.
Yes, and I don't want to call him a fascist, and I don't want to call him Mussolini or Hitler, but
right,
these are exactly the things that these men do. So that's why it is the playbook, and it's been a very effective playbook throughout history to extraordinary ruthlessness and murderousness, of course. These men all took their countries down a deadly and dangerous path. usually, again, in pursuit of their personal aggrandizement of power, mm-hmm. their own egos. They all elevate themselves into a cult of personality. That's kind of those four things you just singled out are the things that kind of bring them to power.
Right.
And then they have a playbook that concentrates that power.
And you want to talk about what's in there? Because these are, I mean, I recognize them immediately.
Well, attacking the courts.
Yep.
We mentioned attacking a minority group or a mm-hmm. foreign group or an outside group or a religious group. So, you know, has this president done these things? Absolutely. I just want to be careful, and I'm not saying this makes him
right.
a fascist.
No, you're this not, but I am. Actually, I am, and I've been saying this and putting up the warning flags forever. And I mean, you can't help but read, you know, once in a position of power, the strong man does some or all of the following. And you talk about moving to control the courts, legislature and elections. Hello, legislature and elections. Heightens an emergency that may not exist. Creates a crisis that may demand military intervention, takes control of the media, increases the use of propaganda, jails or threatens opponents, including journalists, attacks artists, intellectuals, and other free thinkers, sets out to control the education system, attempts to create a young generation of devoted followers, doles out economic favors to supporters and allies, oh boy, creates a larger-than-life cult of personality, either threatens or restricts religious freedoms or bends religion to the regime's agenda. I could make a case for every one of those.
I think yes, in many cases, and that's what these men were able to do in all of the five cases I present here. There was insufficient pushback or no pushback, or the pushback was crushed.
Mm-hmm.
So far, you know, the pushback hasn't been complete. Look, America has never fallen prey to a strong man. We have this this term that we use, American exceptionalism. To me, what is exceptional about America is that in our greatest crises, we didn't have a strong man. In the American Civil War, we got Abraham Lincoln.
Right.
In the Great Depression and the lead up to World War II, we got Franklin D. Roosevelt. Now, both of them are men who made mistakes, had flaws. They were not perfect, but they were the opposite of strongman. And they eventually moved to expand freedoms and rights and privileges and democracy, both at home and around the world, not restricted. So that's what makes America exceptional in my mind to a degree. This was a question at the heart of the conversations, the debates at the Constitutional Convention. And that's why I include a chapter explaining how democracy grew from ancient Athens through the Roman Republic and right up to the point of the Constitutional Convention. These men had two worries, and they were at far ends of the extreme. One is that democracy is dangerous. It's one step away from mob rule. We can't let all these people who, you know, dirty, unwashed, uneducated, illiterate people make decisions for the country. On the other hand, they were really afraid that giving power to a president, a chief executive, a commander-in-chief, giving him control over the army was also a very dangerous thing. So at every step along the way, they created this system of checks and balances. And for most of our history, those checks and balances have held. Right now, those checks and balances are probably under greater stress than they've ever been in our history, except for the Civil War, perhaps. And so that's why I think that this really is a cautionary tale for our time.
Most definitely. And I'm glad that you sort of wrap it up by saying that, look, you say Americans are fortunate to still enjoy the freedom of expression and protest. We're teetering on that one. But as the five stories in this book prove, the guardrails built to protect those rights are removable. A free press can be silenced. Courts can be tilted in favor of one ideology. The powerful can buy access that the average cannot afford. Freedom to protest can be restrained. Laws can be revised or rewritten to take away rights. Once they're gone, such rights are difficult to resuscitate. And then you say, that we're left with hard questions. And right now, Americans really need to be asking these questions. What should we be doing now? What should we be asking ourselves?
You know, Nicole, it really is the question of the book, and there are no easy answers. I'll say that first. I grew up fairly optimistic. You know, yes, there. I knew. I grew up in the 1960s. I saw racial unrest in my hometown around the country in 1967 and 68. I lived through that period, becoming aware politically, I suppose, when I was a teenager in 1968, seeing the Vietnam War, seeing the convention, the riots at the convention, seeing two of the most important leaders of my lifetime, Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy, shot down within weeks of each other, and thinking that this is terrible, yet we did move on from there. We did move on. 4 years later, I could vote because they changed the Constitution to allow 18-year-olds to vote in 1972, which I did, and I voted every year since, and that's where I start. We have the power to affect things by our vote, but voting is only one part of it, not a small part, but only one part. We have a voice. And throughout American history, it's people who have a voice, but maybe don't have a voice, who have changed history, not from the top down, but the bottom up. Abolition, suffrage, the civil rights movement, the labor movement, most progressive changes in this country came from the bottom up, often coming from people who had no vote, but they had a voice, and they took to the streets, and they changed the country. The vast majority of changes to the Constitution as it relates to voting have been to open up democracy, not restrict it. African-American men getting the vote, women getting the vote 100 years ago, 18-year-olds like me, opening up Washington, D.C. to have a voice in the election, which didn't happen until the 1960s.
Well, it's still not fully there, but yeah, point taken.
And still not fully there. The end of the poll taxes, which are making a comeback. The election of the Senate by direct vote, not by state legislature. So every change to the Constitution has been to open up democracy, and I think that's an important point in this. But again, people who don't have a vote have a voice. The late, great John Lewis was 18 years old and black. For those two reasons, he couldn't vote, but he was still out there marching. And he said, in one of his, in the moving last piece he wrote in the New York Times that was published after his death, democracy is an act. Democracy is, you know, it's a verb. We have to take part in this. If we take it for granted, if we are complacent about it, it will disappear, and it does not disappear in darkness. I admire the Washington Post, but I think they're wrong. This history shows that it often dies in broad daylight, decapitated while thousands of people cheer. And that's an important part of the history that I'm trying to tell as well.
That's an amazing line. It often grows. Say that again. It's decapitated.
It's decapitated in broad daylight while thousands cheer. You know, look at those clips of the adoring faces at Nuremberg, or the faces underneath that balcony gazing up at Mussolini as he makes these ranting speeches. These men were able to capture the loyalty, the passion of their people, because they promised them that he would make their countries great again.
It's a frightening prospect. The book is enlightening, though. It's called Strong Man, The Rise of Five Dictators and the Fall of Democracy by Kenneth C. Davis. It is newly out, and it's an easy read and really important information. And it asks the important questions that we should all be posing right now, because we're at a really a turning point in American history. We could easily go one way or the other. I guess it's all up to us. Kenneth Davis, thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking with you. The book is great. I appreciate your time.
It was a pleasure for me as well. If they want to learn more about the book, don'tknowmuch.com is the website. It is also available on audio. And I love to talk about this stuff, as you can tell. So anytime you'd like to have me back, feel free.
I will definitely take you up on that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nicole.
Fascinating man, huh? I will take him up on that. I learned so much from that interview. Kenneth C. Davis, the book, Strong Man. And if you didn't already know, let me drive this home for you. I don't give a lot of premiums out to supporters of the program, but this, I interview a lot of authors. If you hear an interview with an author and you think, wow, that's a book that I really want to read. If you are a supporter of this program, whether you've, you know, sent me a $5 check once, or you're a monthly supporter, of course, I prefer the latter, send me an email. The first person to claim each book will get it. I give them to the supporters of this program. And it's easy to support the program. Just go to NicoleSandler.com, click on the donate page, and there's a lots of different ways you can support us. You can do a one-time donation. You can mail a check. You can do a PayPal thing or a Stripe thing or a Patreon thing or, you know, however you do it. Just know that this is what pays my salary. So I do have all these books. So if, you know, the first one to email me, Nicole@NicoleSandler.com, say, you know, I support your program, blah, blah, blah. And I would like that book, Strong Man. If you're the first one, send me your address. I'll send it to you. It's that easy. All right. I got another interview ready to go who I think you're going to really enjoy. His name is Liam O'Mara, and he's a Democratic candidate running against like a 10-term incumbent in California's 42nd district. We've got a couple of minutes, so I know I tortured you with this on Friday. We're going to do it again because we need a landslide to bring Trump down. This is my latest effort into parody songwriting, and with a little help from Lauren Mayer. Take it away, Lauren.
November 3rd's coming round. Our one last chance to get rid of this clown. In this crucial election, we all have to vote till a landslide brings him down. Oh, ballot in my mail, I fill you out. Find a legitimate drop box so there's no doubt. And I cast my vote early so that it arrives to end this whole season of Trump lies. Well, I've been counting the moments till we get rid of this schmo. As time moves faster, we can end this disaster if we vote for Kamala and Joe. Well, I'm not afraid of waiting in line if it'll turn our country around. Tell the stable genius, take his mushroom penis and evacuate the White House grounds. Cast the votes to evict this clown. We can take back the Senate and take back the town and have no more corruption from this insensitive Scrooge as the landslide takes Trump down. He can't contest the election if the margin is huge. Let's make a landslide to take Trump down. We need a landslide to take Trump down.
Thank you, Lauren Mayer, for putting great singing to my lyrics. All right, let's keep this party going, huh? We're back, and I'm thrilled to be joined once again by Liam O'Mara. He now is the Democratic candidate for Congress from California's 42nd congressional district. And congratulations, because the last time we spoke, you were still in a primary race.
Yeah, we were. Yeah, and California has the top two set, so we're well ahead of the other Democratic candidate and are now facing the Republican incumbent for November.
So the top two came out to be you as the Democrat and a Republican. So you're going head to head. Now, who is the incumbent in the 42nd district?
The incumbent relies on anonymity, on not being well known nationally.
Oh boy,
this is his 28th year in office. He was elected in 1992, in the first year that I could actually vote, my first election, which is kind of insane, I think. But in all that time, he has never chaired a committee and tries to fly under the radar. His name is Ken Calvert.
Mm-hmm.
And you can look him up and see that Calvert is frequently showing up on lists of the top 10 most corrupt people in Congress. He's been investigated by the FBI for dirty land deals, you know, passing legislation to enrich himself. He is 98% funded by corporations. And I mean, the 2% left, I mean, a lot of those are donors outside the district too. I mean, he has no real ties here. He doesn't live in the district.
Wow. And he's running again. So that's who you're running against, the incumbent.
Yep.
Okay. So sort of a no-show congressman. Well, I would guess it's time for a change. Before we go any further, I need to ask, I mean, the district that we're talking about is in Southern California. It's sort of like Eastern Orange County. How are you guys faring with all the fires out there?
Yeah, we're just east of Orange County and LA County, so just over the mountains from both of those, which makes Southwest Riverside County part of the LA metro area. And we've had a significant population growth over the past decade here of people moving out because of the housing prices and whatnot. But we are also much closer to wilderness, and there are a lot of forests in the area. And we actually have some very significant fires in Riverside right now. I know people who were evacuated from them. There's constant smoke in the air. I'm coughing a lot lately because it's been setting off my asthma.
I'll bet. It's frightening. I mean, I left Los Angeles almost 20 years ago, but I still remember, you know, a few particularly bad fire seasons. And what we're seeing now, put those to shame. I mean, what's going on is just unbelievable. It's frightening.
This is and twice in the last 3 years, my house has been directly threatened by fire. It's come really close to them. And it's getting a bit ridiculous.
So Liam O'Mara, you're a first-time candidate for office. You're a professor. You're a historian, right? How does your background help you in terms of going to Congress?
Well, it helps in two ways. First off, I'm a first-generation college student from an entirely working-class family, and I never expected to go to college at all. I mean, I was a fry cook. I drove 18-wheelers. I worked on the waterfront. But I got into college when I was 30 and somehow crazily ran straight through to a PhD.
Wow.
And I've been teaching for 13 years now. And the two of those, the two different sets of background, I mean, first off, I can relate to a lot of people because I share the same kind of concerns. I still consider myself a working class person. I never stop wearing steel toe boots. I mean, I still think of myself as fully part of the working class, and yet I am technically a historian of ideas, and I study public policy, economics, and large systems of thought. And my experience in a classroom in taking complex ideas and breaking them down for people and making it intelligible helps a lot on the campaign trail. People will hit me all the time with like, oh, what the heck is this Green New Deal thing? How the heck does Medicare for All work? We can't handle the debt from that. And I can walk them through how it will actually put money back in their pockets and will let them keep more of their own money that they earn, because I actually understand the policies well, because I'm used to reading this sort of thing anyway. And it actually bothers me that so many people in Congress never even bother to read the legislation. I would be a much more activist Congress critter working hard on the details of these things.
Now, with your knowledge of history, looking at what is happening to this country today, looking at the Trump administration, how they're governing or whatever you want to call what they're doing, and putting that into perspective and into historical perspective. I mean, obviously what's going on in this country has not happened here before, but we have seen vestiges of it play out in history, in world history, but throughout. Where do you put Trump in the realm of world events?
Yeah, it's actually a really complicated problem just because Americans do not understand political terminology well.
Mm-hmm.
We misuse every single one of these terms. We don't use liberal correctly, conservative correctly, socialist correctly. And we certainly don't use fascist correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Trump is, technically speaking, a neo-fascist. His politics are reactionary and nationalist.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem there is that as soon as you say fascist, all people understand is, well, oh, fascists have like death camps and stuff. And and they think of Hitler.
Yeah.
And, well, they're sort of leaving out, what, Salazar and Metaxas. And, you know, there were quite a lot of fascist leaders who did not build these kind of camps. We just don't understand what the ideologies mean, though. And the distinction between a reactionary and a conservative, the distinction between a nationalist and a patriot, these are almost unintelligible for most people.
Mm-hmm.
When I try to bring these things up, I do try to give simple definitions, because it's a problem of both left and right. People often have no idea what they really mean.
Right.
But Trump is definitely a neo-fascist in his orientation, and he's using the same playbook that we've seen over and over again and continue to today. I mean, neo-fascism is active in quite a few countries. We can connect people, you know, as different as Vladimir Putin and Erdogan in Turkey,
mm-hmm.
to the neo-fascist continuum.
It is. I'm glad to hear you say that. I mean, I incredulously listen to the comments coming from Trump, from his mouth and his Twitter feed, and especially the attention that they're paying to Antifa, such as it is. As we know, it's not an actual organization. There's no membership. There are no dues. But the one thing that it does have in common all around is it stands for anti-fascism. And yet you have Donald Trump saying they're the terrorists, the Antifa. And meanwhile, even though the Department of Homeland Security has identified white nationalists and some of those groups, the so-called militias and the Boogaloo Boys and whatever, as the aggressors in many of the uprisings we're seeing, he keeps trying to blame it on, quote, Antifa, which doesn't make sense if you just look at the terminology. It means anti-fascist. I'm Antifa. This disconnect, is just propaganda coming from the administration, or what do people need to know about what they're being fed?
Well, it makes actually brilliant political sense. And it, again, draws on the same playbook that right populists and neo-fascists use all over the world. You flip things around.
Yep.
Vladimir Putin regularly quotes from Ivan Ilyin, who was a 1940s Russian fascist, and uses him in his speeches, but says his enemies are the real fascists. This is exactly what Trump does here. And you see this all over the American right today. Antifa are the real fascists. And I have people telling me all the time, well, they use fascist techniques. And, you know, like, you know, or I'm like, what is a fascist technique?
Right,
like, what
no.
Fascism isn't a thing. I'm like, well, it means like you beat people up who disagree with you. I'm like, no, that, I mean, what? Opposing free speech is like fascism? No,
right.
Louis XIV was a fascist? Not that I saw.
No, right.
But it gets back to us not really understanding what these terms mean. And then, I mean, Trump's own appointee to run the FBI has said repeatedly that Antifa cannot be considered terrorists because they don't fit any of the qualifications that would make something for a terrorist group or movement.
Right.
And yet they'll keep saying it. And that idea of like aiming for the big lie and repeating something over and over so it sinks in, and then it just pops up as an easy answer. Oh, Antifa are the real fascists. Yeah. And they just say it. And that's all that matters. Trump is actually quite a clever politician. He's horrifying as an actual administrator,
mm-hmm.
and he's terrifying as a head of state, but he's quite clever at manipulating a base.
That he is. And in twisting the words and using gaslighting. And again, I talk about opposite world all the time. And this whole, you know, Antifa are the fascists is a perfect example of it. No, it's not. Liam O'Mara is with us. He is the Democrat running for Congress from California's 42nd congressional district. We talked a few months ago, or it might have been a little longer now, and determined that you are the real progressive in the race. You are endorsed by Blue America, among others. Your district makeup, though, it's a bit more conservative, right? Has it leaned Democrat in the past, or is this new ground for that district?
It's a relatively complicated question. The easiest way to boil it down is to think that the demography of the district is overwhelmingly purple. Hmm. But at the congressional level, its voting pattern has been conservative or red. And there's a number of reasons for that, including very low turnout among Hispanic and working class voters in the area. The Hispanic vote is about 40% of the district, or close to 40%, and turnout is usually quite low. And turnout also among youth and working class is quite low. But the last 10 years have seen significant influxes of immigration to the area, both from other parts of the state. So we have a lot of transplants into the new bedroom communities because we're part of the larger metro area, as well as immigrant communities. So we have significant South Asian and Southeast Asian communities now in the northern part of the district. And several cities have flipped to be Democratic majority in the district. What holds it together is the southern part of the district, which is still overwhelmingly upper middle class and red. But the difference in registration is only about 4 points now. I mean, we're at 33% Democrat to 38% Republican.
Wow, okay. Close.
Which means that the margin of victory in every single race is the independents, is the NPPs. And the messaging, I think, really matters more than anything else. And there we are breaking some new ground and running on issues that do have a wider appeal. The closest to what I'm doing, we haven't seen since the 2008 run. And the district back then was 45% Republican, mind you. So it was considerably more Republican than it is now. And the Democrat came within 2 points of beating Calvert. And the key to that was he was running overwhelmingly on economic issues. Mm-hmm. You know, he was running on basic kitchen table economic stuff that I talk about a lot, as well as opposition to our wars, which were, you know, obviously very topical at the time and played into the Obama race. This is a very similar race in that sense.
Wow. Are you outside?
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
I decided to go
right
by. Not usually a lot of traffic up here. But There's a number of similarities here in terms of the kind of turnout we can expect. And if you look at this last primary, you mentioned we talked back last winter, so mm-hmm. It was before the primary. And our turnout in the primary, the Democratic turnout in the primary, was the highest it's been since Calvert's been in office.
It was his
lowest
great.
Margin, his lowest share of the vote since the 1990s.
Wow.
And if you look at, if you compare it to that 2008 race, when Hedrick came within 2 points of beating Calvert, we were 4 points ahead of where he was in his primary. So given the Democrats usually don't turn up as well in primaries as they do in generals, mm-hmm. that bodes well for a turnout for us here in the general. So it really all comes down to whether we manage to reach enough of the independents and sway enough of them.
Well, it sounds very encouraging. I'm going to invite listeners to visit your website, liamomara.org. I will put a link up on my blog at nicolesandler.com to the site, because you go through the issues. You really go in depth. You explain your position on each of them. We went through it last time pretty comprehensively, but basically you are a progressive. This is going to give a real choice to voters in the 42nd district in California, because previous years, and we've talked about this as well, a lot of times Democrats or so-called Democrats running in more conservative districts think they need to be like Republican light. You're giving them a real choice. You're saying, I'm a progressive. Here's what we're for. You can talk about Medicare for All, Green New Deal. You're from that mold, and that message is working for you because you won the primary.
Yeah, and people do know that I'm a progressive. He turned around and came back the same way.
I guess.
Truck must be lost. There are a lot of people that have signed on and support the campaign. In fact, there's a new campaign ad out from, it's based around a testimonial, an interview with somebody that my videographer distilled down to a minute. And he's describing having gone from being a conservative Republican to an independent conservative to, I mean, after a 40-minute conversation with me, he went and registered as a Democrat.
Nice.
And there are people who do self-identify as conservative. They know I'm a progressive, and it doesn't matter because I'm trying to transcend a lot of the labels, the partisan bullshit, and just talk about the issues that affect ordinary people. And I try to frame them in a way that makes sense to the audiences. And I think that that really is the way that we should be approaching red and purple districts all across the country. It actually infuriates me that Democrats don't compete well in a lot of the rural heartland of this country because we used to dominate it.
Right.
I tend to use the term populist more often for myself than progressive, just as a way of connecting back to, you know, everything from like, you know, Truman to William Jennings Bryan to the very founding of the Democratic Party as a representative of the people, of ordinary people. And the fact that Trump was running as a populist helps a bit in a district like this. If you are able to talk about the same issues and the same concerns and fears, but you're presenting solutions that empirically make more sense.
Right.
And that's where my dual background also comes in. Because I can draw upon the data, but put things in terms that working class people can understand.
That's awesome. And you're obviously connecting on a number of different levels, and that's what it takes right now. Any concerns about voting with the games that the Trump people are playing with Louis DeJoy at the post office and everything? Or how do you tell people they should vote?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in California, we don't really have a choice. We switched over to universal mailing for the pandemic, which I actually appreciate a lot. One of the bigger problems there is, again, getting people to turn those ballots in.
We send it out early, right?
Yeah, a lot of them get sent out, and huge numbers never get returned in every election. And that's just from the people who normally sign up to be what we in California we call permanent absentee voter.
Mm-hmm.
So you're checked off to be permanently mail in. So you expect to get it, and still 100,000 people aren't going to turn these things in. I mean, it's very difficult to do. So we will be spending a lot of time on reminding people of that in the last month and a half, you know, a significant get out the vote effort, please turn them in, because not only do you have the people who already expected that who would forget, but everyone, I'm worried about that's the single biggest impact we're going to have. I mean, just given the massive turnout we had in the primary, and the numbers being the best they've been in decades, this pandemic has really thrown things for a loop. I'm grateful, though, that I have such a young and nimble campaign staff. I mean, there's 20 people working for me. They're fantastic people all around. And we adapted very quickly to a digital environment. You mentioned the website, right?
Yes, liamomara.org.
But we do weekly town halls. For months, we did issue-specific ones where we would have guests come in and talk about things. Voter suppression was a weekly one. I had Greg Palast and Harvey Wasserman come on. And we talked about a different issue each week. And then in the last couple of months here, I'm shifting more to like an open voter outreach, kind of an Ask Me Anything, which just makes a contrast with our incumbent who last held any kind of town hall 10 years ago. And has done them very, very infrequently in his tenure. I am determined to be accessible and to talk about these issues. But the voting is going to be difficult in a pandemic. There's no way around that. And we're going to really have to struggle to get people to turn them in.
All right. Well, that's the big reminder that we'll push everyone in. And we'll note as soon as ballots start going out, reminding people to get them in. And if at all possible, I'm in Florida, they've set up drop boxes. And we are permanent absentee voters. We always fill out our ballot and hand deliver them back to the county supervisor of elections office, which is what I highly encourage people to do right now, because you know, I hate to tell you not to trust an institution, but right now I don't know that we can trust the Postal Service.
Yeah, and frankly, we have problems with our own the registrar of voters in our area and them being able to keep up with things as well. In Riverside, we're only going to have a handful of locations where there's drop locations, and the 42nd is huge. Mm-hmm. I personally always take my ballot into the registrar and do it there.
Yep.
I don't really trust all these computers and the mail and everything. Just, I want to make sure it's going to get counted. So I turn it in. But that's from my house, that's a 45-minute drive.
Wow. Yeah, most, and that's the thing. A lot of people can. That's the reason they vote absentee. Do whatever you need to do. Obviously, if you need to use the mail, but give yourself plenty of time. When you get the ballot the first day, fill it out and send it back in. There's so much at stake here. Liam O'Mara, it's great to talk to you again. I'm thrilled that you won your primary. I see you on your way to Congress. Look forward to calling you Congressman when you come back on the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. We recorded that actually a couple of weeks ago before the ballots went out. They're now out. We're voting. So vote and turn your ballot in. And with that, we're done with the colonoscopy edition of today's show. I'll be back tomorrow live, full show live, along with Gotta Laugh. And we'll, you know, see what there is to talk about. In the meantime, vote! Vote. And I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye.